This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Julia Jacobs. Enough should be the central concept in economics, wrote Herman Daly, one of the founders of ecological economics, in the foreword to Rob Deeds and Dan O'Neill's book, Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. The world's economy, as it's currently run, is causing long-term environmental, societal, and economic damage. Joining me now is author and economist Rob Dietz to discuss how he thinks we can reverse this and how we can challenge the dominant growth at any cost thesis of contemporary economics. Welcome today, Rob. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Julia. I really appreciate it.
Nice to have you here. Rob, you used to be the editor of the Daily News, and you were the first executive director of the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. Could you tell me a bit more about the work that you did through these two organizations?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. The whole notion of growing the economy exponentially year after year is something that's pursued by all nations around the world. If you start to take a look at it, you realize that's not sustainable. It's not something that we can keep doing year after year. And if there's something that you can't keep doing, the question is, well, what do you do instead? And Herman Daly was an economist, still an economist, that came up with this idea of steady state economics, meaning that you grow the economy to a size that does not surpass the biological capacity of the ecosystems that contain it. Ecological economics is a systems point of view of the economy, in which the economy is a subsystem of the broader society, and society is a subsystem of the broader environment of the planet that we all share. And so with that central insight, Herman Daly started coming up with the idea of how do you right-size the economy? How do you keep it at a level that meets people's needs without undermining the life support systems of the planet?
And you've run the gamut, you know, you've worked in public, private, and nonprofit sectors involving sustainability. So how has all of these experiences informed, you know, the sustainability agenda that you are now pursuing today?
Well, I've learned a lot from being in all these different places. You know, in government, the idea is often that you're trying to regulate businesses or private interests to achieve some kind of public goal. So I've been in that role. But I've been in the private sector where you have an organization that in order to survive, you've got to be profitable. And so it's a very big challenge, say, for a business in the private sector to achieve environmental or social goals if it does not align with their revenue goals.
Revenue goals, yeah.
So, you know, just trying to understand that balance and seeing the operations of the economy from both sides. And I've also been in nonprofit enterprise, which is, you know, sort of between the two. So I think it's given me a chance to see the challenges of the different sides and find ways to work with all of them.
So I guess all of this can be summed up as, you know, the pursuit of infinite growth in our finite planet. And a lot of our problems our environment is facing is because of this. Mm-hmm. So as I mentioned earlier, you co-authored the book Enough is Enough with Dan O'Neill. Could you just tell me the story of this book and what brought you to write it?
Yeah. So I was working for the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy and running the Daily News, and we're putting out a lot of articles and writings. And you know, often you focus on the problem. You think, you analyze what's going on that's not working. And I started talking with Dan O'Neill. I brought him in as a writer for the Daily News as well. And he came up with the idea of having a conference where we bring together some of the best minds in ecological economics to really try to lay out what would an economy of enough look like? What policies would we need for a steady state economy? And we had this wonderful group of people who came together in Leeds in the United Kingdom, and we came up with a whole bunch of ideas out of that, and we wrote a report, and you know, it was nice. We distributed that, but we said, you know, we have a lot of really amazing material here that we'd like to get to a broader audience. So that's when I decided to basically go on leave from running the nonprofit and try to get it all down in a book that hopefully is easy to read and makes a good case for changing the way we run things economically.
Okay, so in and through this, you're spreading the word about the idea of a steady state economy and the idea of forming your economy around the idea of enough rather mm-hmm. than around the principle of more. So what is a steady state economy?
So at its simplest, a steady state economy is one that achieves stability in the throughput of energy and materials. And if you're thinking about that, you probably need to think about stabilizing the number of people that you have in the economy. And then the other piece of it really is instead of trying to maximize profits or aiming for growth as a goal in and of itself, mm-hmm. you aim for quality of life. Really, the end goal of a steady state economy is sustainable and equitable well-being. That means well-being for all people that can last over time so that you're not some of the way that we're running businesses in the economy now, we're eating into the potential of future generations mm-hmm. to thrive. And so making it very explicit, sustainable and equitable well-being, that would be the goal in a steady state economy.
Okay, so how is progress achieved in an economy that is kept within a steady state?
Well, the idea is to focus specifically on development rather than on growth, to focus on quality instead of quantity. You can look at a whole bunch of policies whereby you slow down the economy. But if your economy is structured the way it is now, that causes problems. Mm-hmm. So you've really got to have a different set of institutions and policies in a steady state economy. So, for example, think about employment. Right now, if GDP growth slows, people lose their jobs. That's not going to be sustainable over the long term. People need to earn incomes. They need to have work. So you've got to have policies that address employment. In an economy like the United States has, we've got many, many people who would gladly trade some of their income for more time.
Yeah.
And so sharing work is a kind of an obvious policy that you could use. Yeah.
Just talking about GDP, you argued in your book that the GDP is, which is the main economic indicator in use today. It's a very poor indicator of progress. But, it's also probably the most politically influential of all indicators out there.
Yes.
So why did you come to that conclusion then?
Well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, one, the whole idea of GDP was as an accounting of output. The person who came up with the idea, Simon Kuznets, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, he made very clear to warn anybody using this measure that it was not a measure of progress. One of my colleagues, Brian Check, and some others, along with Herman Daly, they actually published an article in the journal Nature where you can show that the GDP is as it grows, it's correlated with loss of biodiversity. In fact, they propose it as an indicator of biodiversity loss. And there are other reasons too. GDP counts defensive expenditures. So by that, I mean you can think of, let's say there's an auto accident. Yeah. You have an ambulance that has to come out and pick up the injured people. You have trucks that come out and clean up the cars and take them away. You have the repairs to those cars. You have the medical bills to people. That's all included in GDP. And to think of that as adding to the well-being of people is crazy.
Yeah, so it doesn't distinguish between the benefits and the costs.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, so.
And there's no way you could say that's a measure of progress if you're adding all these horrendous costs into it.
But, people always they worry when they hear that the economy is not doing well because, like you mentioned earlier, concerns about unemployment and stagnation. Are these valid fears in a steady state economy?
I think there are, yes. I don't want to pretend like a steady state economy would be immune to the problems that a growth economy has. But the idea is address them explicitly. Mm-hmm. So, when people say the economy is not doing well, they're usually talking about GDP is not growing or it's not growing fast enough.
Yeah.
Well, that's a really poor way to decide whether your economy is doing well or not. Why not have measures that look at the well-being of people, that look at the state of your environmental systems, that look at the health of the economy rather than the size of it? And that's really what we're talking about in the movement to a steady state economy. Get measures for the things that you really care about, and then try to implement policies that support improving those measures.
I'm speaking today to Rob Dietz. He's an author and an economist, and we're discussing his book, Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. Coming up after the break, we discuss some of the several initiatives that have, you know, investigated alternatives to GDP. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, PFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. I have the company of Rob Dietz today. He is an author and economist, and we are discussing Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. So, Rob, you mentioned alternatives to the GDP, and several initiatives around the world, they are investigating these alternatives. Mm-hmm. For example, like the European Commission's Beyond GDP initiative and things like that. Mm-hmm. Could you give us some examples that you've come across?
Yeah, I would be happy to. When Herman Daly first started looking at this and he saw these problems of adding costs and benefits together, he said, well, we should separate those. And he and a colleague worked on that. And then that work turned into a measure called the Genuine Progress Indicator. And what it really does is it tries to separate those out, mm-hmm. take the costs out, these defensive expenditures out of the GDP. And so you get a more honest accounting of what is the actual size of the economy. My favorite sort of summary measure is something that the New Economics Foundation in the UK came up with called – it has kind of a whimsical name, the Happy Planet Index, and a really interesting ratio. What they do is the numerator in this ratio takes account of how long are people living in a country, okay. What's the lifespan,
okay.
And combines that with – how happy are they with their lives? So you have this objective measure of the lifespan, and you have a subjective measure of how happy are the citizens.
And the quality of that lifespan,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so the denominator is in this ratio is ecological footprint, which okay. is a measure of essentially how much resources are being used in the economy and how much waste is being emitted. So it's a ratio of what is the amount of resources we need to take in to achieve long and happy lives? And when you look at that measure, it's nothing like the rankings for GDP. You have a country like the United States on top in GDP. Well, it's not even in the top 100 in Happy Planet Index. And why is that? Well, in the U.S., people actually live a pretty long time. They're pretty happy. But our ecological footprint is off the charts. You mm-hmm. have, you would need 4 times the land area of the United States for the biological capacity that we're currently consuming. And you can only do that for a certain amount of time before you really push the system, push the environmental systems into a state that probably isn't going to be one we can thrive in.
And I think we're already more or less there.
yeah. Yeah, I try not to be too doom and gloom and pessimistic, but when you do look at the markers loss of biodiversity, climate change, alteration of geochemical cycles with nitrogen and phosphorus. It's some scary times.
You call yourself, the gloom, no, the cheerful...
cheerful doomer was an idea I came up with, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, as you get involved with conservation biology or climate science... There's huge amounts of doom and gloom.
It
can be enough to drive you to a depressed or a despairing state. But I realized pretty early on getting into this space that really all you can do is change your own behavior, change the things that you do, and do work that's in line with your values. And that actually, I think, helps you keep a pretty sane head and keep a sense of humor about things. So, that's kind of where I was going with that name.
And you have a daughter, I recall reading. I suppose just thinking about the future generation also forces you, for lack of a better word, to be cheerful and to be sort of positive about it.
Yeah, and that's right. I think... it's easy to vilify, the evil polluting corporation or something like that. But I think, those are people who work there. They have children too. They want to see a world that we can all inhabit, that we can all thrive in. And people generally don't want to see wild areas completely disappear and species going extinct. You know, people often want the same things. We just have institutions that aren't set up well to achieve those goals. And the idea is let's start really thinking about how to do that rather than putting all of our energies into growing an economy that is already overgrown. Let's put all of our energies into creating an economy that works for us and is commensurate with conserving the life support systems of the planet.
Yeah, so, you know, achieving a steady state economy, it's been likened to finding a Goldilocks scale of the economy, a size that's not too big and not too small. Is this an ideal that is actually achievable in reality? You know, do you think governments would be willing to go for a more steady state economy?
Well, I think it's going to be probably forced upon them. I don't think you're going to see a whole lot of voluntary, you know, my experience is in the United States. If a candidate comes out and says, you know, my platform is to stabilize the economy, I doubt they're going to get a whole lot of support. So, you know, but you already see that happening to some degree. Japan has not achieved the growth that it has targeted.
Yeah.
You know, it has not turned the country into misery. But think about that. An economy that's really designed for growth, they haven't been able to achieve it. So they're having to adapt. And I think going forward, the idea is, well, let's have policies that really make life the way that you want it in a stable size of an economy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have to realize just because you're stabilizing the size of an economy doesn't mean you're stabilizing the innovation, the technology development,
yep.
the chances for people to pursue the opportunities that they want to pursue. It just means that the overall size is not increasing.
But, you know, most people, they subscribe to the bigger is better mentality. You know, mm-hmm. how do you even hope that people can make this transition from a growth imperative to an enough imperative?
Yeah. Well, you know what? I think for me, I always take it down to a more personal level. It's kind of hard to think about things in this macro aggregate scale. So I think often about my own personal life. So, for example, you think bigger is always better. Well, how big of a house is too big, or how big of a meal is too big? You know, like we know when we're eating, when we've had enough to eat, we feel good. You know, we feel energized, we feel satisfied. Same with sleep. You know, if you get too little sleep, you're not doing so well. If you get too much sleep, you're groggy. But if you get the right amount of sleep, if you get enough sleep, you feel good. And I think people generally get those concepts very readily. It resonates with all of us. The same is true of our institutions. You know, if a corporation gets too big, it's got too much power, becomes very top-heavy. You get problems like income distribution that we've seen, where all of the money flows to the top 1%.
Yeah.
The idea is, you know, people can recognize the benefits of this enough mindset in their own lives, and we just apply that to the larger scale.
Well, it's easy to say that to, I suppose, somebody like you and me, but how would like a hedge fund manager who I know in your research says they earn I don't know how much per hour compared to, you know, which is enough for a family for 2 months or 2 years.
Yeah.
How do you even hope to sort of change their mentality about something like this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure that you can change their mentality given the system that they're operating in.
Because why would they want to give up all they have, right?
Yeah. Well, and you know, but at some point it gets kind of crazy. Yeah, I mean, the idea of making more than $1 million per hour. I mean, they couldn't possibly figure out what to do with all that wealth. And there's, at the same time, people who are struggling to get enough to eat. So it doesn't make any sense. And I don't think anybody looking at it objectively would say, yes, that person's work is so valuable that they need $1 million per hour. You know, we're not talking per year or per week, you know, or per hour. So, you know, I think the idea is to set up institutions that keep that from happening. So, you know, the research is very clear on this. Societies that are more equal in their distribution of wealth and income do better.
Mm-hmm.
They have less health problems, less problems with addiction to drugs, less problems with crime, you know, all across a number of social indicators. Societies do better that are more equal in that distribution. And so setting up policies that allow you to achieve that would kind of eliminate the whole notion of having to convince that person.
Exactly.
You know, if you have a ceiling on the amount of income, I mean, there's just no one who's going to say, yeah, you should get $1 million per hour. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and poverty is generally what sparks all sorts of problems, like the health problems, the social issues and everything. So yeah. If we could have like a sort of balanced income for everybody, that would sort of eradicate those problems. You mentioned some governments have done that. Do you have any examples?
Well, you see a lot better spread, say, in the Scandinavian countries than you do in the United States. And it's really interesting. You can change relatively quickly. After World War II, Japan actually had a very, very high discrepancy between the poorest and the richest people in the country. And the U.S. was relatively even.
Yep.
And they've completely switched places now. The U.S. has become, you know, among the high consuming countries, one of the least, one of the worst at having a large gap between the haves and the have-nots. And Japan has gone the other direction.
Do you think there's a natural limit to the growth of an economy, though?
Yeah, I think there clearly is. And I think the hard thing is that it's a little difficult to see with your eyes. You know, you don't see the climate change, and it doesn't happen overnight.
Well, not overnight, but you can see the effects.
Yeah, you see the effects, and it often takes reaching a crisis level before we'll act on it.
Yeah.
But there's a limit, you know. Okay, if we in a fossil fueled economy, the emissions are accruing to the atmosphere, and the atmosphere can only assimilate so much before you change that system. You know, the same would go for any sort of extractive industry. You have a limit to a non-renewable resource. You cannot,
exactly.
And even with a renewable resource, there are limits. You know, you've got to choose an extraction rate that is below the rate of regeneration. So yeah, I think there are natural limits. You know, we live in a real world that's governed by physics. It's not governed by economics. It's governed by physics. Our economy has to fit within the parameters of the physical world. And it doesn't mean that we can't be more efficient or find ways to maybe extract a little more out of the system than we used to be able to, but there are still those limits. But the good news is that I think you can find ways to live happily within those limits. Sometimes trying to grow makes for a very harried existence. You're just always on the run, always trying to produce more. And then you end up consuming more, and there are serious problems with that.
And wasting more as a consequence. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it can lead to really perverse incentives. You know, it's almost better to have a throwaway economy because that helps you grow faster.
Yeah. The other thing is that the effects of climate change, as we were talking about earlier, they're already upon us, whether we want to believe it
right.
or not. And, you know, COP21, the agreement in Paris last year, that marked a turning point in building a low carbon economy. It's been hailed as a turning point for action to limit climate change below dangerous levels. How did you feel about the Paris outcome?
You know, I think it's a step in the right direction. I feel, frankly, I'm kind of scared. You know, I would like to see much faster action on achieving limits to
carbon emissions.
Yeah, to carbon emissions. And I think we're going to face a reckoning. I mean, if you are switching to an all renewable energy to power the economy, you have to think about powering down somewhat. You know, I'm involved in a farming enterprise now, and you think about a 450 horsepower tractor that runs on diesel fuel.
Yeah.
How do you run that on electric batteries at this point? I mean, it's not going to be nearly it's not going to be something that's easy to do. So, you know, you might have to power down somewhat, which means changing the infrastructure, changing the way we're behaving. And, you know, that takes time. So the faster we can start doing these things, I think the less disruption in people's lives. And that's the whole idea is to, you know, we want to live good lives, and we certainly don't want to invite misery into our societies.
So you do think it's possible then to respond to climate change and still have some economic growth as well?
Well, no, I do think we need to curb the notion of growing the economy. But I think what you would see is replacement. So, you know, certainly the solar energy economy would grow while the fossil fuel economy would shrink.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's been the story of the economy all through history. You have certain sectors that rise and replace ones that fail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And where should leadership on climate change be coming from? You know, what role do the businesses and communities play in this?
Well, I think from a moral perspective, the leadership should come from those who have emitted the most. The United States, Western Europe, Japan, and the businesses that have spurred the most emissions. I think they should take responsibility, take leadership. It's a pretty sad story in the United States. A lot of the oil companies have been supporting campaigns of misinformation, and that's got to change. We've got to be accountable for the things that we do, and I think those businesses would be much better served by saying, okay, we know this is a problem. We know that the way we're operating is a problem.
Yeah.
And we've got to make changes. And you do see some responsible businesses that they're very long-lived. In the book, we talk about one of them, the Collins Pine Company. It's a timber company. You know, you think of timber extraction companies kind of like, ooh, the bad guy environmentally.
Yeah.
But they've been around since 1855. They have formed their business all around sustainability principles. They recognize that they have no business if they can't take care of the forests that provide the products that they sell.
Yeah.
And so they are excellent stewards of forest resources. You can find plenty of timber companies that will say they are excellent stewards, but they don't do the measurements. They don't have the scientific data to back up those claims. So yes, I think companies that are causing environmental harm, countries that have benefited the most from economic growth, they've got to take a leadership role in the transition to sustainability. And, you know, there's a lot of countries that have not had the opportunity to have the economic benefits that have accrued in other places. And they should be given they should not be given, but they should have the ecological space to be able to grow. But globally we're facing limits, and so we've got to figure out how to work through that.
Yeah, so let's hope, you know, the Paris outcome, there is an actual outcome from it.
Yeah.
So you are also currently a project manager with Farmland LP, as you mentioned just now, which is a benefit corporation that converts conventional farmland to organic.
Yes.
With a goal of managing farms sustainably. Could you tell me more about the work you're doing through this?
Yeah, and it was funny because after I wrote the book, I was proud of the book, and I thought, okay, Dan and I, we put some good information out there, but I really wanted to work on something that took some of the ideas we were using in the book and make a difference on the ground.
Put it into practice.
Yeah, and I had a friend named Jason Bradford who started this organization with his business partner, Craig Wishner. And the idea was, I think of it like an Aikido move. You know, in Aikido, your opponent comes at you and you use their momentum and redirect it. Well, you know, we have a financial system that's given. We have an agricultural system that's given. So the idea was, how can we take the financial system and change agriculture to move it towards sustainability? And so Farmland LP is an investment fund. We raise private equity.
Okay.
There's a lot of investors who, they've done very well in the modern economy. They want to put their money into something that they know has a future, will be good for their kids, will be in alignment with their values around environment and social justice. And so we've been reasonably successful at raising some funds. And then what we do is we buy conventionally managed farmland, you know, using synthetic pesticides and fertilizers and we convert that to organic, where we try to manage over the long term for soil fertility, for environmental health. And given the structure of the market for food today, you know, organic food has a price premium.
Yes,
so there's a good opportunity over the long term for us to bring a return back to the investors based on that price premium. And it's all fueled by the demand for organic food in the United States. And I don't have the stats globally, but in the U.S., it's growing at about 15% a year.
Which is quite a lot, yeah.
Yeah. And the problem is the supply of organic land, You know, if you're going to have organic food, you have to have land that's certified organic. It is not keeping pace at all.
Yeah.
And so that's where we have an opportunity. We can step in and work on that conversion process, which takes 3 years, and then give organic farmers an opportunity to grow food on the land. And so, yeah, it's an idea of just trying to do right by the soil and balance that with the financial obligation to our investors.
So do you approach these farms individually, like the non-organic ones? Do you approach them individually and then sort of say that you want to convert it into an organic farm? Is that how it works?
No. What we do is we basically wait for a farm to come up for sale.
Okay,
and if it's in an area that that we're interested in working, you know, we analyze on a number of fronts. You know, what kind of soil does it have? What kind of access to water is there?
Okay.
You know, how does it sit geographically with our other operations?
Yeah.
So it comes up for sale, and if it meets what
criteria
we're looking for and the price is right, then we'll consider purchasing it.
So,
then we just put our transition into place.
So this again is a marriage of economics and sustainability in its own way.
Yeah. I mean, I really think, it's one thing to write a book and to say, Here's how the economy ought to be. It's a whole nother thing to go out and try to make that happen. And I think the two most important sectors that we've got to be working on are energy and agriculture, really at the base of any economy. You know, without food, you're not going to have an economy for very long.
No.
Without energy, there's nothing to run the economy on. So that's really where we've got to be focusing on, I think, starting the changes and making the transitions.
Okay. Thank you so much, Rob.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking to Rob Dietz. He's the author of Enough is Enough, Building a Sustainable Economy in a World of Finite Resources. And the book is available for sale on Amazon?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Rob. Any last message you'd like to leave us with?
Oh, I'd just like to say that I think the economy does not have to grow to thrive. We need to strive for development rather than growth and recognize that enough is enough. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob. That was Rob Dietz, an author and economist. And this is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.